Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 10th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host. 20 years ago, a mass strike process exploded in Eastern Europe as years of pent-up anger against the tyranny of communist dictatorships burst into the open. It was 20 years ago yesterday, October 9th, 1989, that the mass strike emerged as a transformational force in the city of Leipzig in Eastern Germany. And shortly afterwards, marching under the slogan, "We are the people of East Germany toppled the dictatorship of Erich Honecker, leading to a chain reaction collapse of governments throughout Eastern Europe. However, unfortunately, that process did not end so well. A new tyranny, perhaps relying a little less on force and more on playing on the illusions of the people, was imposed on Eastern Europe under the direction of British Prime Minister Thatcher, her puppet French President Mitterrand, and both of their puppets, George Herbert Walker Bush. And what resulted was a European Union dictatorship, which prevented the real potential of a unified Germany to lead Europe into a new political and economic renaissance. Today, 20 years later, the mass strike process, which occurred in Eastern Europe, is spreading to the United States as the whole world economy is disintegrating, exactly as Lyndon LaRouche had said that it would. Today we're seeing this process unfolding in American cities, with people who were not previously politically active organizing opposition to the fascist policies being imposed through the presidency of Barack Obama, who, just as his predecessor George W. Bush and both of their predecessors, George Herbert Walker Bush, Obama is functioning as a puppet of British or Anglo-Dutch fascist forces, the same ones who prevented the reunification of Germany from adopting the policies of Lyndon LaRouche. On the LaRouche Show today, we'll celebrate the courage of those brave souls who 20 years ago stood up to Honecker, stood up to the police state in East Germany, and toppled that government. We'll get an eyewitness report from Leipzig of the commemoration of that day, which took place yesterday. And we'll hear from two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement in the United States who are in the middle of the mass strike process here with Americans who are in motion, and how they're organizing to take this otherwise unformed mob of angry, frustrated people and bring them into support of the LaRouche plan to reestablish the principles of the U.S. Constitution with a credit system modeled on that of Franklin Roosevelt. So it sounds like we're going to be covering a lot, and we are. So let's first let me greet from Wiesbaden, Germany, Rainer Oppel, and also Karsten from Leipzig. Rainer, let's start with you. Tell us what happened 20 years ago in Eastern Germany.
Well, what happened is a process that actually has a lot to do with Lyndon LaRouche at that time, as it does today with the mass strike ferment in the United States. So how's that? The usual story you get from the mass media and the history books is naturally only the facts. The facts are that in sometime in spring 1989, there was a broader protest movement in East Germany in the context of manipulated municipal elections. So here a lot of initiatives filed protests, risked arrests, and so on. Then we had a few weeks later, we had the crackdown in China, the Tiananmen Square massacre of early June 1989. And this naturally led to a mass movement in the form of refugees. So here the traditional summer holiday period was used by tens of thousands of East German citizens to go as usual to the neighboring Czech Republic, to Hungary, to to Poland, to the Black Sea, that is Bulgaria, for example, but also Soviet Union. and with the decision not to return home, because many of them were dissidents, one form or the other, and had to fear that a crackdown was also imminent in eastern Germany as the situation was coming to a peak, undersupply of food, collapse of the energy and transport system, and it was a very dramatic situation. So here in the summer of 1989, we had this refugee wave, and then...
Reiner, when you say there was a refugee wave, was this people leaving the East to come to the West, or were they going into other countries?
We were not so far advanced. So many of them made to the to Western embassies, naturally also the West German embassies in these states. I mentioned trying to get special visa, so there was a lot of diplomacy. It was a very difficult period. It was just when in August, I even have to look for the exact date, late August 1989, that the Hungarians opened their border to Austria, and then and several hundred first, and then several thousand of East Germans that had spent the holidays in Hungary just made to Austria and then to West Germany. The situation
was... Just to set the stage a little bit more, most of what we heard initially in the Western press was that this was completely unexpected. But those of us who were reading what Mr. LaRouche was saying were not so surprised, because he had been talking about the breakdown process going on in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe 5 years earlier, warning that this would happen.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to come to that point, just recall some of the facts for you. So the refugee wave then escalated up to the point that that nearly 4,000 East Germans were on the territory of the West German embassy in Prague. And here, now here we enter the next stage, because now a situation was reached that was no longer tolerable for nobody, not for the East German regime, nor for the West German countries, nor for the Soviet Union. So here an arrangement was made at the beginning of October 1989, that these 4,000 East Germans would be allowed to go west, but they had, which was a condition the East German regime set, which was backfiring. They would only be allowed to go west by coming in special trains via East German territory. And here, we had the these trains coming through Dresden and the city of Plauen, which is, unfortunately, you don't have a map in front of you, but it's in southeast, the southeast of eastern Germany. And here we had the first protests and also gatherings of dissidents. And you have to see that scene. And a few days later, it just happened that the East German regime celebrated its 40th anniversary. And Erich Honecker, the leader of East Germany, said that that socialism on its way will neither be stopped by ox or donkey. It's a very rude translation of what he said in German, but that's what he said. So. And they had all these flags and all the music and parades, and so that was October 7, 1989. October 9, 2 days later, we had this first big mass rally in Leipzig. There had been protests before, but now it was simply exploding. It was 70,000 people in the streets of Leipzig, and it was no longer possible to contain that. 9 days later, October 18, Erich Honecker was overthrown. We had a transition regime, and then we got into this whole process of the dissolution of East Germany and the perspective of reunification, which even at that time most people would not have believed it would be possible, became much more visible, and this process came to conclusion on October the 3rd, 1990. So within 1 year after these mass rallies, we had the reunification of Germany, however under conditions. Now, just a few remarks on the role of Lytton LaRouche, which initially mentioned in 1982-1983, LaRouche proposed to the Soviet Union, which was then headed by Yuri Andropov, that one should overcome the partition of East and West and work for a joint mission. Now, as far as the nuclear weapons threat was concerned, he proposed a strategic defense initiative, which is missile defense systems that would be developed in a joint effort between the Soviets and the Americans. So he addressed here an original impulse that was still there at the end of the Second World War under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who actually planned that after the end of the war, reconstruction of Eastern Europe and cooperation with the Soviet Union from the wartime period would be continued in the peace period. As we know, this was destroyed under a British-oriented policy of President Truman and so on. So LaRouche did that in 1983. Yuri Andropov turned that down. However, the proposal did not die down. It was in the drawers and the possession of many people, East and West, and LaRouche made similar proposals again. And then the spectacular thing he did was on October 12, 1988, at an international press conference at the Bristol Hotel in West Berlin, which is 1 year before these mass rallies in Leipzig. And there he said that the perspective of reunification of Germany and Europe is there. And there's an offer to the Soviet Union to work with the West, reunify Germany and liberate Poland. And all that would serve the purpose of developing Eurasia.
Reiner, it should be noted for our American listeners that that October 12, 1988 address by LaRouche was broadcast as one of his half-hour TV broadcasts in his presidential campaign at precisely the point that then Vice President Bush was involved in a campaign to throw Lyndon LaRouche in prison.
Well, which happened in January 1989.
Right.
However, that did not, LaRouche addressed this process that was underway and was natural. It was a genuine impulse of the nations of Europe to overcome this partition into East and West, to overcome the Iron Curtain. And that process was already there. LaRouche saw that very clearly, although most people said, you are crazy, there's no such thing. And, well, we had this process as I outlined. It just came very rapidly, and it...
And Reiner, let me ask you on that. As it unfolded, a lot of people don't realize the risk that was taken by the first groups of demonstrators. Just give people a sense of the kind of police state that existed in East Germany, and also the threats that the administration, the Honecker regime, was prepared to machine gun demonstrators.
Yeah, that was all there, with the first wave of refugees we met here that arrived in West Germany, we interviewed them for our newspaper and other publications. So they all told us their genuine interest was to go to the West before the crackdown would occur in East Germany. We had here on top of the well-known police state, which was the police, first of all, which was the political police, the Stasi, Staatssicherheit, state security apparatus, political police. We had additional instruments of state security, and we had the army, naturally, which was deployed inside. And we did have these so-called Betriebskampfgruppen, which is factory-based defense units that would train regularly and would also be deployed to crack down counter-revolutionary movements, as they were called by the East German regime. So the first protesters, these were just in the summer of 89, while the first waves of refugees were going away. people would protest in East German cities, maybe 100, 200, maybe a couple hundred in Dresden, Leipzig, and usually there was a crackdown, there were arrests, and this escalated to a point that on the very eve of, actually hours before people set out for the Monday, October 9th mass rally in Leipzig, that people sat down, this is well documented, sat down with their families, writing up their last wills. You have to imagine that. Writing up their last wills because they were not sure to come home after that mass rally. They would be afraid to get arrested, to be put away for 10, 20 years. Maybe they would be killed like those in China a few weeks earlier. And that was the situation. So here we had this complete build-up, and it was just amazing to see that in face of these 70,000 that said, no violence, we are the people, no violence, that the whole security apparatus simply crumbled away. The police would not move against the demonstrators, the militia stayed aside, the army would not move, so the whole state security apparatus just crumbled, and that was the end.
An incredibly dramatic moment, and it what your description just brings to mind the words of the poet Shelley, where people are willing to risk everything because they're moved by the spirit of the age, the idea that there's no longer any reason to tolerate this tyranny. And Rainer, you were in Wiesbaden at the time. It was pretty moving spectacle to see these demonstrations grow so large so rapidly and bring down this government. I assume that it was quite moving for you.
Well, absolutely, and at that time it was not, it was very difficult to cross the border because the border between East and West Germany still existed. So it would only be possible under special conditions to cross it. I myself and my wife, we were in Leipzig in January 1990, a few weeks after these events, and still we had big rallies. I think when we were there mid of January 1990, there was still up to 250,000 people in the streets of Leipzig, which was then what it was, 300,000, 400,000 we had. You have to imagine, in all major East German cities, we had rallies, not of a size as in Leipzig, but you had a couple hundred, a couple thousand. So there was probably that day, October 9, 1989, we probably had a 250,000, some people say up to 500,000 people of a total population of 17 million in the streets protesting. And that was the situation.
Well, let's jump forward 20 years, and yes. I want to bring Karsten in. Clearly these 20 years, the promise and the hope of 1989, which was a central theme of both Lyndon LaRouche and then Mrs. LaRouche in Germany, putting forward her proposal for the Industrial Triangle for economic development, and it did not happen, largely because of the role of Thatcher. And as Karsten, why don't you tell us, before you give us a report on events of yesterday, I assume that in Eastern Europe, in Eastern Germany, the unemployment is high, the economy is still pretty depressed, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really devastating. I mean, it has become normal for young people to basically emigrate to the West looking for jobs. And there's also the phenomenon of radicalization, that people become either left-wingers or right-wingers. And that always happens. If you don't give people a future, you know, people become demoralized, depressed, and get stupid ideas. But you also meet older people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who became unemployed when the wall fell, as all these government-owned companies got shut down, and they're still unemployed. They haven't had a job since then. So you can imagine the demoralization. And you have to picture this, that the kind of process that happened in West Germany and the United States over 20, say 30 years, happened in East Germany in 3 to 4 years. A complete shutdown of almost everything that smelled like industry.
And so you had this great moment where people rose up, they showed courage, they toppled a hated regime, and after 20 years, as you're talking, there's youth unemployment, there's drugs, there's the collapse of education. So what happened yesterday with the commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the great events of 1989?
Well, this was quite awesome. This was quite an event. I have to say that I myself was part of the original 89 demonstration. I was 5 years old, and my mother took my brothers and myself to the demonstrations. She saw this was really a mass phenomenon. You were taking the small kids. And I still recall that my mother then said, and she also told me later, she was saying at that time while they were marching, "We are writing history." So everybody knew that there was something big going on. And what I really found impressive yesterday in Leipzig and at this 20-year anniversary of this first mass demonstration of 70,000 people then was that they had brought a lot of original footage there. I mean, the first obvious thing to consider is that the commemoration was in Leipzig, in the same streets where people were marching. So a lot of the people that were there were people who were marching then, who took part in shaping that history then. And what they had done, they had historical footage on big screens showing the demonstrators then shouting, "We are the people," out with the Stasi, the secret service. And there wasn't even, because you just talked about that, this possible violence. It was very peaceful. They even chanted, the demonstrators chanted toward the police, "Join, join, schließt euch an." So, and I'm sure a lot of the police at that time didn't know if they were on the right side.
The spirit of 89 was sort of rekindled then yesterday.
Absolutely. You could see in people's eyes, you know, people were really in awe. I mean, obviously the people that were there at that time, but even the young people, you saw they had some sort of respect. And also the people that were there were totally open for us being there as a political movement. And I think if we wouldn't have been there, there would have been something missing. Because I think everybody there asked himself, well, okay, this was 89. This is what we did. We fought for this. Now, why did we do it? What's the situation today? What does this mean now, today, as we stand here in the face of the greatest financial and economic crisis since who knows when? So
Well, I was just going to ask, what did we do then to intervene into this process yesterday?
Well, what we did is we set up in the central place where the historical Monday demonstrations in 89 started, which is straight out of St. Nikolai's Church, and there was the peace prayer, which also happened in 89, that was the start of the demonstrations, and we set up right outside that church, had a big chorus, a banner with the slogan of Honecker that Rainer was just referring to, but we changed it a bit. The original is, "Socialism in its course is neither stopped by donkey or horse," and instead of socialism, we put in globalization. So, because a lot of people know, everybody knows that slogan, so people were having a good laugh that, and today it's ridiculous, that slogan, because everybody knows a few months later the whole regime collapsed as he was saying this, Honecker. And then you look at the politicians today and they have the same kind of what we call concrete-headedness than people then. They can't see that their system is just totally coming down.
So people looking at this and the population got that irony then.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a bit of a paradox because you had the banner, people were laughing at this, but and then we had the singing, obviously. That was the biggest impression, I think, that people got. We were singing the same songs that these people were singing back in 89, which is "Die Gedanken sind frei," the traditional German tune, "The Thoughts Are Free." And we're singing "The Ode to Joy" by Beethoven, written by Schiller. And this has had an enormous impact. I haven't seen anything like this in a long, never actually, because it was really like then. We had an enormous crowd around us, people watching us, people taking pictures, taking videos, old ladies joining the chorus, singing along with full joy. People were moved to tears. People were total awe. Even, you know, our activists were almost moved to tears. We had to stick to our guns so we could continue singing. it was really quite amazing. We got our 12,000 leaflets. We sold a whole bunch of DVDs with this 89 movie, which we had produced. So this was great.
And this is, you mentioned to me earlier that there's footage of this available from the website, the German website, is that right?
Yes, and I think we're also making it available to LPAC TV.
Okay, so we're talking with Rainer Oppel and Karsten from Leipzig, our new LaRouche Show correspondent, who's joining us to discuss the events 20 years ago and today. I'll be joined in a moment with a couple of LaRouche Youth Movement organizers from the United States. But Rainer, let me go back to you. When you hear this report from Karsten, and there was just an election in Germany, which had a pretty horrible outcome. Looking at this, one of the things we talked about a couple weeks ago with Karsten and Elke Thimmen was the potential to revive the spirit of 1989 and the fact that given the crisis, this would be something that's necessary. Do you see that as a possibility now in Germany, or is it going to take time for this to occur in the United States? How do you see this unfolding today?
Well, I see that absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, we say it's a missed chance of 1989. That's true. A lot of hopes were betrayed. On the other hand, I would always add, but it is an unfinished agenda we are going to finish. And the election results, well, all in all, concerning the way the establishment, political establishment, recomposed itself, it's bad for Germany. But this leaves out one factor, which is reason for optimism, that we got very good election results for the LaRouche Party, the Büso, where Carsten Werner was a leading candidate in Saxony. And Saxony is a state where all the main mass rallies of 1989 take place, and I must add, it happened again in 2004. This I have to mention. Helga Zepp-LaRouche, the chairman of the Büso Party, in July 2004, at an absolute crisis of economic, social, and other conditions, she said, "We need a new policy, and what we need, we have to revive the spirit of 1989. People have to reactivate themselves, and we have not only to protest against the government's policies, but we have to demonstrate for a new world, a new just world economic order." And then she wrote a manifesto, and that manifesto started the Monday rallies again in July 2004. And within several weeks, again, we had in more than in 80 cities, we had 300,000 people on the streets, 350,000 people on the street. So this showed, this 5 years ago, it showed that this is perfectly possible to revive it again. If we see the election results, maybe Carsten Werner can also comment on that directly. In Saxony, it's the highest, accidental that we have the highest recognition factor here in Germany for our movement, and it is I think right there that we can revive the spirit and change things and finish the agenda, which was not finished 20 years or 19 years ago.
Well, Karsten, it sounds like what you were saying is that spirit to pick up the unfinished agenda is there still.
Yes, and I mean, the thing about this event yesterday and also what we are doing as a movement is exactly to give people the right social and mental environment in which they can just function on a totally higher level. And I think with what I described, and if you look at the footage, you get an idea of that. I mean, you would have to be there, but if you have this kind of footage, there was also classical music in concerts, you know, people get reawakened, people get a sense of who I really am, what our real culture is. Man, we were writing history 20 years ago. What the hell am I doing sitting in my place and complaining about these politicians? Let's do something. And to get a sense of sovereignty as a real human thinking individual.
Well, Rainer and Karsten, I'd like you to stay with us because we're going to hear now from Rihanna St. Klausis and from Paul Marino. Rihanna has been, for the last months, in Boston, where there's been a very active mobilization in the whole of New England, but Rihanna was there when the infamous confrontation happened between the LaRouche Youth Movement member Rachel Brown and the Barnum and Bailey Circus Act, Barney Frank, who lost the debate with a dining room table, I think. But and Paul also has been very actively involved in Texas, where you have, on the one hand, you have the kind of nut side of the Tea Party. People are talking about leaving, seceding from the United States, forming their own state. And you know, I joke with them that if they do that, we're probably going to get Texas taken over by the Mexican drug mafia. But I'd like to start with Rihanna. You just heard this report from 1989 and then 2009. It's not quite the same, but tell us a little bit about the spirit that you saw in key people who are just becoming politically awake in the United States, both in Boston and then since you've been back in Seattle.
Well, it's been it's very interesting because you see a lot of people who are very, very unhappy with the way that things are going and would probably have identified themselves with one of the political parties. And we get this phenomenon a lot of people who will come up and, you know, I'll say, well, look, Obama is a continuation of the Bush administration. You can go through it, how identical they are in policy and in many respects. And, you know, the person I'm talking to will look down and shake their head and say, well, you know, I voted for Bush. I kind of like Dick Cheney, but, and I'll give them a quizzical look, and then they'll say, well, they really lost it that second administration. And then they'll look up and they'll say, well, okay, they were never good. And, you know, you get that also with people who come up and say, I see you're comparing Obama to Hitler here. And I have to say I don't agree with his health care reform either, but I did vote for him. And you can tell that a lot of these people were trying to figure out how to make things work in the country. And they've been very confused by how bad things have gotten.
And you get a sense they're losing confidence in the political establishment and both parties?
Absolutely. And in fact, actually yesterday we had a very funny interaction with a state representative who identified himself and came up to our table and said, he started to berate us and explain why we had no credibility. And I told him, well, I think LaRouche has credibility for his forecasting record in economics, and I think you and your fellow elected officials have lacked credibility, which is why the population responded to you the way they did in August. And I think you have a rude awakening coming, in coming elections. And he got very upset, and he said, those were just a couple crazy people at those town hall meetings. You know, everybody focused on just a couple crazy people. And I said, oh, they were just a couple crazy people? And, you know, it was very funny because, of course, what we did see at these town hall meetings were just incredible turnouts. They were stunning. You know, you have a town hall meeting at a high school auditorium, and they wouldn't be able to seat all of the people. The people would be, you know, going all the way around the building, and you know, they would be of all different political backgrounds. They had different. A lot of them had some very crazy ideas, but they would have handmade signs, and a lot of what they wanted to do was try to fight out a real policy, so that our organizing there was incredibly important. And they often took up our poster of Obama with the Hitler mustache, and that really did become their banner. You would see them holding it up, holding up the image, and you know, in these town hall meetings. And in fact, the mainstream media really made they cut Rachel Brown's statement to Barney Frank, and they tried to make it look like she was just one right-wing whack job who got put down by the ever funny Barney Frank. But if you actually look at some of that footage and you hear her entire question, the audience was very supportive of her, in fact. And you look in, if you look at some of the imagery of different pictures, not the ones that were on the, you know, the Washington Post article and whatnot, you see people holding up our pamphlet, in support of her. Because Barney Frank identified the Hitler mustache and said, how can I take you seriously? And Rachel told him he's in support of a Nazi policy.
And I think one of the things that's happened is that the congressmen, the senators and House members were so frightened by the turnout that they're now hiding in Washington. In fact, Harry Reid, the leader, the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, said there would not be a traditional Columbus Day recess, which is this week, because they didn't want people going back into the district and running into mobs of people again. Let me bring in Paul Marino, who Paul has been working with networks in of two different types, but you actually see a coalescing. On the one side, you have the Tea Party people who essentially were being organized initially as an anti-tax, anti-government movement, but they then sort of combined with Ron Paul supporters who were against the Federal Reserve, and they ran up against their limitations pretty quickly. But you also have people who are the so-called progressives who thought Obama was going to really give health care to people instead of run an insurance company swindle. And so you now have the progressives who are starting to raise questions. Paul, what's it look like when you go to these meetings and rallies in Texas?
Well, it started as a simple tax protest or populist anger from certain problems is beginning to deepen. And the leadership, the people who have greater intellect than just the populace, have been reaching out to us. In the last couple of weeks, we've gone back to a number of people we've met over the course of August, and they happen to be in positions of responsibility and leadership in various groups, whether it's a Tea Party or a Ron Paul support group or maybe some of Hillary Clinton's old campaigners. These things mm-hmm. tend to overlap in a very interesting way. And the better these people are bringing us in for dialogue. They want ideas. They want to discuss economic policy because they don't have anything clearly mapped out on how to solve the economic problems they're all facing. And the tenor of discussion at some of these things is often, we're going to be killed by inflation, we're going to be killed by this bailout, there's no jobs, and the people who are there in the audience are convincing us how bad it is, giving it one horror story after the other, because they see mostly people their own age. It tends to be older boomers, and not a lot of young people at the moment, but that's beginning to change. So them seeing us there participating, let me tell you how bad it really is. And of course, when we agree with them and articulate even what the solutions are, that just takes the discussion even further.
Well, Paul, let me get to the solutions, because this last mm-hmm. week we had the consolidation of a number of comments that Lyndon LaRouche has made, and then his recent writings on economy and science. Has been consolidated into what's being called the LaRouche Plan, which starts with this idea of ending the bailouts, putting the banks through bankruptcy reorganization under Glass-Steagall standards, and going back to a credit policy. I know we've just started to go with this, but I'd like to ask both Paul and Rihanna what kind of response we're getting from the initial forays with the LaRouche Plan as a coherent set of principles that solve this crisis. Paul, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, they want to discuss it. At the moment, the leadership of some of these groups are asking us to come in and address them first, so they have a chance to think about these various things. They're moving cautiously, and they're trying to avoid all kind of opportunism that's out there. There were a couple of groups that I've known about that go back to the recall to the governor of California, Governor Gray Davis, and some of these Tea Party networks picked up on that element out there and avoided discussing any politics or policy with them. So there's a good nose some of these people have. And at the moment, they're struggling with the idea of principle or good government, the idea that FDR did work and in principle can work again. That's something
Are you finding on the FDR question, because I get this a lot, that people are starting to rethink, because the initial impulse from the Tea Party types was no big government, FDR's big government, Obama's big government, and now they're beginning to realize that the dividing line is that FDR took on the banks, whereas Obama is an agent of the British linked banks. Are you beginning to get a shift on the FDR question?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Give me just a little bit on that.
Well, it comes up. Perhaps someone who initially was a bit angry with FDR, FDR is the cause of all these problems. You present some of the simple paradoxes of what he did, you know, on day one, taking on Wall Street, and immediately the person is forced to reflect upon what they thought they knew. Obviously, Obama did not do that on day one. He went right along with all of Wall Street's plans. So that weighs in there big time. Also, the policy of Glass-Steagall. You outline to them how it was FDR pushed that through. They all agree with that. Yeah, it's necessary. That's good. Why can't we do that now? So they're beginning to drop some of these things. And it just, we have to do more of that, obviously.
And Rihanna, what are you finding with the LaRouche plan up in the Northwest now?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say that that's what people are really hungry for. I mean, they're trying to figure out why things are so wrong. And the healthcare is, you know, really it is just one aspect of the whole picture, which is what we saw at these town hall meetings anyway. I mean, a lot of people were turning out because there's 30% unemployment or more. I mean, in the field, when I'm talking to people in many different areas, like in, you know, around the area of Boston and Saugus, for instance, or Lynn, Massachusetts, you know, they'll tell you, I'd say 30% unemployment, and they'll shake their head and say, no, from my experience, I say it's more like 50. And I've gotten that a lot. And one thing I've also gotten a lot of are young people, or, you know, younger in my age range, in their early 30s, who made a lot of money doing nothing at one point, and they're totally, they have no idea what happened to them. I met a guy who was a lawyer for Merrill Lynch. He basically, you know, his neighbor worked, was one of the executives, and he got in on the ground level and was making over $100,000 a year his first year. And he said, you know, I thought we were the you know, kings of the world, and everybody else was a sucker, because he was covering over what Merrill Lynch was actually doing. And he said, then last year when the whole thing went down, he's completely out of a job. He was wasting money. I mean, some of the stories he told are probably not good to repeat on the air. But, I mean, he's just burning money like crazy. And he said, now I don't know what to do. I've been unemployed. I'm working as a legal aide. I can barely make my rent. I got myself into a mortgage. I don't think I can keep it, but I can't sell my house. I don't know what to do. And, you know, I started to go over with him about how, you know, we actually needed banking reform. We needed Glass-Steagall. We needed to prevent Merrill Lynch from having been able to do anything that they had done. And it was funny because I could tell he wanted to fight me, and then he had to agree. He said, yeah, I think I was the sucker. I've gotten that a lot. People who will fight, Ron Paul supporters who, you know, I'd say, look, we probably really disagree about government intervention in the economy. I think we need FDR. And I'll go through something like the Tennessee Valley Authority and how that worked with the cooperation between a government agency and the private entrepreneurship. And they'll agree. They'll sign up. They contribute. They become members of our political action committee, because in a sense, it's so simple. And because of how bad things have gotten at this point, they can really see what we need.
Well, let me go back to Reiner and Karsten on this, because you've just heard the reports from Rihanna and Paul, and you can see, I'm sure, from the reports you're getting in the media, that there is a certain desperation in the United States. I don't know whether you're getting accurate reporting other than from our publication. And by the way, I should say, if you really want to know what's happening with the economy, whether it's in Germany or in the United States, the global economy, the breakdown, the warnings, the forecasts of this from LaRouche, you have to go to LaRouchePact.com, because we're the only ones who cover it. But Reiner, let me just ask you, as part of this election process in Germany, there was the story of the green shoots of recovery. But the reports I've seen in the last few days from you and your colleagues in the Wiesbaden intelligence, clearly exports are breaking down, industry shutting down, steel and iron production is collapsing. What is the situation in Germany? It's obviously not a recovery.
No, absolutely, absolutely not a recovery. It's quite the contrary. If people are talking about the recovery, the question is, what are they actually talking about? Because it cannot be the real economy. The real economy is just fading away. I mean, if you have steel production in Germany down by almost 50%, you have exports, in spite of all this recovery talk, still down 20 to 25%. In some categories, exports are down 50, 60, 70%. For example, machine tools, heavy transport equipment, construction vehicles, trailers. These are all categories of products that see collapse of exports by 60-70%, and that after some time that also corresponds to a cut in production. I mean, firms, as long as they still have hope to recover, they will continue to produce a bit, but not the full scale, but they will produce a bit, but after some time they will stop producing because they can no longer do it, and we have arrived at that point, and we will have cutbacks. During the election campaign, there was all this talk about the upswing, this tiny recovery, which was an 0.1% increase of GDP in the second quarter of 2009 as compared to the first quarter of 2009. That's not what you call a recover. It is so minuscule, you need an electronic microscope to see what's going on there. So that's not the way to deal with things. What we have in Germany, what has covered up the situation, is that the government has excessive arrangements for short work. That puts a worker on actually up to zero work for 1 or 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks a month. Officially, they are not in the unemployment statistics. Their wages are paid by the government. That is the equivalent of 14 billion euros. That's close to 20 billion dollars per year in Germany. But that can't go on because the companies that still have these people on their payroll nominally, they also have to provide the costs for keeping the actual workplace. So,
well, Carsten, given this report that Reiner's just given us about the real economy in Germany, I remember a few weeks ago you were talking about in the period of 1989 that no one believed the media, no one believed the government when they talked about the great progress being made. Are we seeing something similar today, a discrediting of government institutions and the media?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that you always have to mention it to people that the media is lying, and then they say, oh, sure. But if you don't say it, you know, people still, I think out of desperation and out of, you know, look for a future, they still buy into it sometimes. But you just have to make them aware of that. Actually, on that note, yesterday, one of the things that made the thing a bit eerie also is they played original speeches through these typical megaphones on a build-up on a car from different speakers of that time from the Soviet, from the GDR regime, telling people to calm down, you know, going on the streets is not the right way. And really, this reminds me very much of what we're hearing in the from representatives of Congress to the in the United States, you know, it's just right-wingers, you are extremists, you know, but people today don't buy into it. And the one advantage we have here is that you can use this historical example of people being in the Valley of the Clueless, which I had mentioned to you 2 weeks ago on the show,
right,
that the area of Dresden didn't get the Western TV, so they would only get the very narrow view of the existing regime, and so they didn't know what was going on in the Western world. So they were called the Valley of the Clueless even during that time by people on the streets. So, and that is how the media is keeping, you know, us today in really the Valley of the Clueless, because we're not getting accurate reports of what's going on in the United States. Here and there, you will get a picture of a tent city, and then but that's only marginal. There's not real coverage. So that's really where we come in.
Well, and I guess, you know, I'll be coming over shortly to present some reports on the situation in the United States, in France and Germany, as Mr. LaRouche's spokesman, to give this picture. Paul, would you say that from what you're seeing, are Americans beginning to realize that if they listen to the media, they live in the Valley of the Clueless?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, some of these guys with the groups we're meeting with, they're going after the national media and bringing along a lot of the local radio and local television with them. Like sitting down, they're finding out that a lot of the local guys just don't have the resources to cover what has to be covered, and so they want help to cover accurately what's going on the ground. So yeah, people are breaking out of the shackles that the mass media has put up for a long time.
Rihanna, let me ask you something. You've listened to what Reiner's had to report and Carsten Werner's report from Saxony. What do you think? Do you think we can get the American people to see that 20 years ago, under conditions that in many ways were worse than what we face in the United States, at least in terms of an oppressive regime, but that people did rise up? Do you think we can get this idea of we are the people? Is that coming across to the people you're talking to?
Yes. And in fact, I was very moved by Carson's description of both what he experienced as a child in 1989, and then how that was reflected today. And that is exactly what I think we need at this point, because like I said, people do realize that when LaRouche says we can revoke the bailout, that we can put this whole system through bankruptcy, that the $200+ trillion on the books of Bank of America and Citigroup and all of these is totally unpayable and unbacked by any asset, and that we can wipe it all out and rebuild the country and instigate the space program and send people to Mars. And they get very excited, and then they get pessimistic when they look down at our Tantamount to Treason pamphlet with Nancy Pelosi, Barney Frank, and Chris Dodd's faces on it. And they say, well, how are we going to do it? And that's really the pessimism that we're fighting, because people have a sense of the need for the change, and they get very excited about the possibility for it, and then they get very pessimistic.
Well, I think, Reiner, I'd like to ask... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, what I would add to that as well is that what I've seen in the last week is that these guys are being the branch out, going door-to-door, going to churches to convey what they're trying to do to outflank all the hysteria you find in the national media. So the process now is becoming organized. It's not becoming a new political party yet, per se, but I would say that generally these people see themselves as trying to inform the rest of the population about what's going on. And they're just looking for more ideas and more weighty ideas that they can use to help that process along.
Yeah, that one phenomenon that we're getting a lot of as well are people who will talk to us and say, oh, okay, this makes sense. And then they'll stand by the table and start to try to organize the other passersby with us. And because they have an impulse for wanting to organize the population themselves.
I guess the self-organizing process is what went on in 1989, Reiner?
Absolutely. I mean, people, unfortunately, I don't have the time to describe all that, but people took enormous risks to self-organize in that period. You also see from the way it is described how people prepared these protest rallies, especially the first ones where they would always have to risk getting arrested. So they were talking in East Germany. They were talking at their firms with colleagues they knew were critical of the things they were gathering somewhere in a pub or gathering somewhere else. They organized a typewriter. Somebody wrote a leaflet, and at that time they didn't have Xerox machines. They did carbon copies. So, for example, one guy did 200 leaflets, so he had to type again and again the same leaflet to do four or five carbon copies of that leaflet. So that's the way it was, and they did it, and people were arrested, and they kept contact, and they built this. By the way, I have to mention that the Americans really have to consider this revolution of 1989 their own, because the main slogan was "We are the people."
Yes.
No, it nominally it comes from the which people always refer to. It comes from the revolutionary uprisings of 1848 in the middle of the 19th century, which unfortunately also failed. But originally, it comes from the United States. It comes from we the people, and that you know very, very well. It comes from the United States. It came here through the constitutional movements that wanted to finish off the oligarchy and build a true republic. This was an original American impulse which lived on. And you see that. And in addition, we have that in the first bigger protest rallies in East Germany in the summer of 89, the weeks before that big rally in Leipzig, people were also singing "We Shall Overcome," which was as you well know, one of the main songs of the Martin Luther King citizen civil rights movement, which was ironically popular in East Germany in the 1960s because the East Germans, the East German regime, because of its anti-Americanism, thought it was useful to make public this protest movement against the Vietnam War and racial discrimination. So it did have a tradition in Eastern Germany. And then what I mentioned in the beginning, the underlying process, which has to do with what LaRouche has strictly addressed. I just want to mention shortly that at various times we intervened again, for example, Helga Zepp-LaRouche in as a few days, I think it was October 18, also a few days after the Leipzig rally, wrote a memorandum for the reunification of Germany. She addressed that to Chancellor Kohl. It was interesting to see that this and a couple of other memoranda she wrote to then West German Chancellor Kohl somehow made their way into this famous 10-point program, which he read in the German Parliament on November 28. And in that 10-point program, there appeared something which was directly resembling what LaRouche and Helga Zepp-LaRouche said before, namely that the development of infrastructure between East and West, the Eurasian perspective, would be absolutely crucial. And
you know,
LaRouche said in Berlin in this October 12, 1988 press conference, he spoke of the transport
corridors.
Yeah, transport corridor Paris. Is a natural transport corridor between East and West, as running between Paris, Berlin, Warsaw, and Moscow. You see, and 1 year later, November 28, 1989, Helmut Kohl, the German Chancellor in the Bundestag, in his 10-point program said, we must also think about reconnecting the transport routes. And he put it the other way. He said, Moscow, Warsaw, Berlin, Paris, said Helmut Kohl. So it just showed that these proposals were, LaRouche proposals were extremely popular, and they were popular.
And Reiner, I think at some point, we're almost out of time, but at some point we should do another program on reviving this question of both what Lyndon LaRouche and Helga Zepp-LaRouche proposed at that time, including the Eurasian land bridge,
absolutely,
and how that's part of the global infrastructure need for a four-power agreement today. Before we go, Carsten, I'd like to just ask you, I also was struck by your comments about being a five-year-old at that demonstration. Is that part of the reason today why you've become a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement in Germany?
Maybe history works like that.
Well, I think the inspiration, huh?
Yeah. It always moves me again and again when I look back at this. And I just want to say as a message to the Americans, I mean, we're really counting on you guys, that you guys get, there's a lot of people here on the streets we meet every day who are now getting slowly but surely disappointed by Obama. But if we are talking to them about what you guys are doing, they get a sense of hope. So you have your work cut out. Please do it.
Well, I think
thank you.
I think the main point, if you think about the four of you and what you've been talking about, there are two points that stick out, and we're down to about the last minute. So in closing, I think the important thing is that we're fighting the same enemy today in terms of this Anglo-Dutch financial system, the oligarchy, the monetary imperial system, the same enemy that the American founding fathers fought. And they applied the ideas of another great figure from Leipzig, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, to create our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. So the idea has always been that on both sides of the Atlantic, there's been this opposition to this Anglo-Dutch financial system, which comes from Venice, which comes from the Persian Empire before that. And what Lyndon LaRouche has identified in his new papers is that now, because of the globalization, the process of making this global empire, we now have the opportunity to defeat the empire globally with the four-power agreement. And that's what the LaRouche plan is about. So I'd urge all of our listeners to go to the website, We have a two-page PDF version of the LaRouche Plan, and we're going to put out a pamphlet on the LaRouche Plan. We need your funds. We need you to be involved in this. And as Karsten pointed out, the people of Germany need the Americans to continue this mass strike. So Reiner, Karsten, Rihanna, and Paul, thank you very much for your input today. This has been the LaRouche Show for October 10th, 2009. Join us next week at the same time, Saturday, 3 p.m. on LaRouchePub.com for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.